In 2018, maybe 2017, I don't remember now, but a while ago, I got my hands on a culture book for a fashion company. Now, if you're unfamiliar with what a culture book is, it is this document or resource that a company or an organization will give to new team members as they are onboarding. And the culture book outlines that company's behaviors, their values, their ethos, and the culture book itself is meant to help new team members understand what it's like to join this organization. And so I got my hands on this culture book for this fashion company, and it was beautiful. It was this really soft, heavy cotton stock paper, and all of the contents of the book were letter pressed in this really soft black ink. And flipping through the culture book itself felt like a mini retreat of sorts. Just feeling it in my hands and holding that texture was incredibly inspiring to me. I'm pretty sure I still have that little book somewhere in my office here, but I'm telling the story about this little book and the tactile nature of it and the sensation of holding it because I experienced this book during a time when I was really grappling with what it meant to address issues of racial injustice in the world and was kind of stepping back and observing everything from activism to changes people were trying to make in their organizations. And my overwhelming sense as I held that beautiful little booklet in my hands was, wow, I wish that social change could feel like this. I wish that social healing could feel like this book. I wish it could feel inviting, and I wish we could lean into our softness, and I wish that our way forward in the world could really be more beautiful. And it was lofty, and it still is in some ways, but when I think about what it means for us to create a more beautiful way in the world, I think it's really important that we have those touchstones of inspiration and beauty that remind us what we're even advocating for, what we're even moving towards, and why it's important. I love that little book, and I hope you're inspired to think about the little areas in your life where you experience just enough beauty to know that another way is possible. Welcome to another episode of A More Beautiful Way, a podcast hosted by me, Bethany Wilkinson. Here at A More Beautiful Way, we are dedicated to slowing down, simplifying, and finding the sacred in our shared modern life. Three practices that are pretty easy sounding in theory, but in practice, it's really countercultural actually to slow down, to simplify, and to find the sacred in the midst of all of the different challenges and obstacles and difficulties we're navigating as individuals and collectively. I'm really grateful for all of the love and support that last week's episodes have received. It's been such a gift to receive your text messages and your emails, and it's just really fun when you create something and it finds resonance out in the world. And so thank you so much to those of you who listened, who shared, who let me know that you were listening. It really means the world to me. And if you want to stay in the loop, you can, of course, subscribe to the show here on whatever podcast player you're listening to. You can leave a comment or a review, good, bad, or otherwise. That's how people find the show. You can also visit www.amorebeautifulway.co, and you can subscribe to the weekly email and be sure to be in the loop for all the new offerings that come through this platform and project. So glad you're here. I'm really excited to share today's conversation with you. It is one that I recorded back in 2022. And so for some of you, if you have been like a really attentive follower of my work, you may have heard this conversation before, but my guess is that it's actually going to be new to many of you. I had the chance to interview Leah Palmer from the Wild Mother Creative Studio, which is based in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And I interviewed Leah because when I first started thinking about what A More Beautiful Way could mean as an invitation to the world, her work and the work of her sisters was top of mind for me. I'd been following Leah and her sisters on Instagram for a period of time. I'd also been following their work at The Wild Mother, and the way that they work with floral design to not only support their clients as a business, but to invite their communities into ceremony and sacred remembrance of historical harms and injustice happening in their community, or that happened in the past and happening in real time. Just the way they leveraged the beauty of floral design in order to tell a story and to advocate for change and to make a difference. I just hadn't seen anything like it. And their work is just so beautiful, so thoughtful and intentional. And it really encapsulates for me what it means to leverage beauty, to work with beauty in an effort to create a more beautiful way in the world. And so I could say a lot more, but I really want you to get into the conversation because Leah kind of tells the story of what this means and has meant for her and for her community. And it's just a really beautiful conversation if you're interested in creativity and beauty and the arts, as well as in healing and racial justice, then this is the conversation for you. Enjoy. I am so thrilled to be having this conversation with you, Leah. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
My first question for you is kind of a broad one, but my question is, where do you begin? You as a person, you as a creative, you as a human in the world, where do you begin?
I love this question. It's such a kindred one because whenever I'm doing facilitation work or leading as an artist, this question about origin always comes up. And so I like to think about my ancestors a lot as I think about my work, or even just, you know, myself as a person. I come from a line of Baptist ministers and musicians and artists. I come from mothers who, gave endlessly to their children, and in doing so, to me as a descendant. I come from enslaved people, sharecroppers. I come from a band of Choctaws who ended up here in Oklahoma after the Trail of Tears. And I come from, you know, Oklahoma City. We are eighth generation Oklahomans. So all of those things are definitely like in me, cannot be removed from who I am, and have inspired so much of why I do what I do in the world.
Have you always moved through the world with a heightened or a high or a strong level of awareness of the people you come from, or is that something that you had to choose to go find as an adult?
I think there are different layers of that. Yes, at some level, I had no choice because my elders were always talking about people that came before me. They were like, you know, legends and figures that I knew certain phrases or little jokes that would be said by my Papa Perry, who I never met, but I know his personality because of them. And then there was definitely a moment where I decided to own that knowledge and wanted to have it for myself so that I can share it with others. I think there have always been layers of that.
I would love to hear about the nature of your work. So what is the nature of your work in the world? You briefly touched on facilitation, what is your work?
This is a complicated answer. So strap in. So my work really began in university as an undergrad and grad student. I studied literature, and I was really interested in using literature to understand identity. So I was looking at African-American lit and Native American lit primarily in like the 19th century, that time in America's history where there's this, like, I don't know, I felt like it was an identity formation moment for the country. And so it just fit that all of my work was centered on how identities get formed. In the process, I was working with my dear sisters, Lauren and Callie, to build a brand called The Wild Mother. And we do floral art. So we were starting with like events and weddings, and we're very creative. So using really any medium of art was our goal, to try and make it through the world using art. And then in about 2016, there was a moment where things sort of started crashing down, and I realized that I wanted to find the marriage between this art space and some of my research in identity, and do some anti-racism, social justice work. And that's where that facilitation comes in. So we started a nonprofit called the James and Elnora Boykin Arts and Culture Foundation. Those are my grandparents' names. And there's a project called the Conversation Workshops that we work on there. And it's an anti-racism curriculum. So we do that. And there's one more thing I should mention. We kind of figured out in 2020 how to bring together art and activism as florists. And we've created a project called Send Flowers To, which is also under that foundation. And we create site-specific floral installations that really just highlight some hidden histories, histories that didn't ever really receive justice. And in a lot of ways brings honor and memorial to groups of people who never really got it. And it's probably my favorite part of the work I get to do.
So many beautiful and powerful offerings to the world. I was trying to remember how I found you and how mm-hmm. I found The Wild Mother. I have no idea. I can't remember what happened or how I found your work online. But what I have so appreciated about the work that you do and the work of your sisters and you all as a team is how you so powerfully and intentionally integrate art and justice and flowers and beauty and a commitment to a place and mm-hmm. a commitment to your history and to your future, the future, mm-hmm. and to the futures of Black people in general, and of communities that have so often been denigrated in society, but also have these rich and important legacies. And so it's just a really powerful intersection of work. And I have some questions about some of the specific projects you mentioned, but before that, I mean, one word that we cannot avoid is that you're really creative.
Thank you.
And when I think about creativity, it's not just like the skills that you have, but it's like, when I look at this, it's like, it's pouring from every orifice, it seems, from what I can perceive online anyway. I know that's the medium's not in person, but you're creating so much. And so I would love to hear from you what makes such prolific and intentional creativity possible for you.
Wow, that's a good question. You know, there's probably a good mix of things. I love to bake. And so I think there's probably a lot of ingredients in that bowl. Some of it is like just straight up personality. Like, I have a feisty, fiery personality. And so when I am ready to say something or ready to communicate an idea, whether it's through art or words or even just hosting space for people, I am usually not shy to do that. Like, I'll go for it. I think there's that element is personality, but also I think that, I just had people in my life who created safe spaces for me to do that. I remember when I was little, one of the most profound things my mom did for me that I plan to do if I ever get to have children, she would, before I was able to read or write, she would sit down with me at the end of each day, and she kept a journal with me. She asked me what I did that day and what I thought about it and how I felt and what ideas I had. And she wrote down my thoughts. And these were thoughts from like a 2, 3, 4-year-old little girl, you know, in a world that where little Black girls' thoughts and ideas and imagination is usually pushed to the side. My mom cared about that stuff and kept really good record of that. So there have been people along the way like her who treasured my ideas and who were keepers for me, safekeepers for that creativity. And maybe I just live in an illusion that it's safe to create always. but I do, I feel that. I feel confident that the things that I want to say or that I believe or that I want to put into the world belong there. And I have to attribute that to people before me who taught me that posture.
Yeah, I love, I can't remember the word you used, that they were keepers.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It made me imagine a world where we can continue to be keepers of one another's creativity and one another's stories and offerings.
It's so important. I think that is so important. If we do not work to not only keep our own stories, but to keep each other's, I think that so much gets lost. So many important people and stories become lost in the slow roll of history. Mm-hmm. And so I love a world where we keep things for one another.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really great segue into my question about the Greenwood District.
Yes.
Which from what I've gathered is in its own way, a story keeping and a story reclaiming. And so can you share with the people what that project was, what it is now? And yeah, just tell us about it.
I'd love to. Yeah. Thank you for asking this question. It's actually such a part of keeping that you would ask that question. So the Greenwood District was the result of some migration patterns from Black people, especially after emancipation, after enslavement. And people were looking for ways to get out of the South, which obviously was a really traumatizing landscape and had very little promise for raising families, for growing businesses, for living peacefully. And so they looked out. And Oklahoma was one of these places where all Black towns started popping up all over the place. And one of them was this district in Tulsa called Greenwood. It actually became known as Black Wall Street eventually by 1921. There was this vibrant 40 square blocks of culture and art and community and family, business, religion, every level of society you can think of was so sustainable there. There's statistics on how far $1 would get passed in that community, and it really created wealth for Black people in Tulsa. So unfortunately in 1921, as you can imagine, there was lots of just tricky race-related outrage, really, about the success of Greenwood. White Tulsans were, the way I would describe it, I think, is just experiencing some jealousy over the wealth, over the land ownership, over the home ownership. I mean, these homes, if you can picture, like, legitimate mansions. This is where Black people were living just 50 plus years after emancipation. This was not the expectation for Black people who were meant to stay, you know, in shackles really in our culture in order to maintain wealth for other groups. So anyway, the outrage was real, and a mob of about their numbers that say about 10,000 white people gathered in Tulsa after an incident that was really not to the magnitude of the destruction that they created there, but ultimately in about 14 hours, the whole district had been burned to the ground. Homes and churches, lots of establishments, buildings, and lots of people had actually, you know, Black men were there to defend this district, and they, lots of people died. There's record of about 300, but one thing that's really interesting about this event is that almost immediately after the destruction in Greenwood, there was a pretty like strong position from the Tulsa World, which is a local newspaper, still exists, and from other news outlets to sort of twist that story and create a narrative where Black people just destroyed themselves, which we know makes no sense, you know. And that narrative persisted while, you know, Black people were trying to heal, and essentially the history got so buried in 100 years. So that kind of brings me to the project that we started, the Sunflower Shoe Project I mentioned earlier. We were up on the centennial anniversary of the Greenwood Massacre, which is how we talk about it today. Some people call it the Tulsa Race Massacre too, of 1921. And this history had largely still remained undiscussed. Whispers between families who were involved in the massacre, whether they were victims or they were involved in the mobbing, that those stories were all just whispers. There are still unmarked mass graves that are being exhumed right now of bodies that are believed to be victims of the massacre. So history has totally done a number on that story. And it was in this 100th, the centennial moment, that local organizers started creating efforts to tell the story, to memorialize the victims. And we kind of jumped in as artists, trying to figure out how could we highlight this hidden history? How could we also, as florists, you know, a lot of times flowers are used to communicate. And so how can we communicate like loss and grief and honor for that community? And the Sunflowers to Greenwood project was born. So we found ourselves in May installing this beautiful floral installation at the Standpipe Hill, which is a site where white mobsters actually were able to gain high ground, and they were using that to sharpshoot and kill Black men who were defending the town. So we reclaimed that land with our floral installation, and there was a ceremony that day, a collection soil ceremony on the 100th anniversary. And it was just so deeply healing to share flowers with even the three last living victims of that event. So that was Sunflowers to Greenwood. It was truly one of the most powerful things I think I've ever been involved in. And it came with, I should mention, it came with so much support. A huge part of it was a community of florists really gathering together to raise money to purchase these flowers and to install these flowers. And it was just an incredible outpouring.
Really powerful. I'm gonna keep using that word because that's how I understand it. And just so moving and important. I'm curious, how did just like everyday neighbors receive it?
Well, I remember we got to the site at like 5:30 in the morning and started unloading these trucks and all of this donated material, including like scaffolding and things like that to hold the installation. And by about 8:30, we had finished the project. And it was in that cleanup moment, there was this older gentleman. He was probably in his late 80s or 90s, older Black man who came to Standpipe Hill with his daughter. And this was before any of the ceremonies were scheduled to start. So he must have just wanted to come and stand on that ground. We approached him and got to talking to him about his connection. He said that he was a descendant of victims of the massacre. And with tears in his eyes, he thanked us for just the outward display of care for him and his family. And we shared one of our bouquets with him that he could take with him. And then we got to thank him for being resilient. We learned that he was actually a minister and that he carried the legacy of his ancestors who were in that massacre in his daily life. And so we got to thank him. And it was just one of those very hallowed moments, you know, just very reverent. And all of the interactions that I remember that day felt that way, felt very, very deeply profound with people from Tulsa and then with people who were just descending on the town to be a part of the centennial events.
And one of the phrases I've gathered from your work is art is medicine. And as you describe the work at in the Greenwood District and the art installation you did there, yes, absolutely. Art is medicine. Art is healing. And so I'd love for you to share what that phrase means to you and what do you hope it might mean for all of us?
That phrase probably came out of one of those feisty moments with me and my sisters. Probably one of those moments where we were like, what is going on? You know, like, what can we do? Why, especially regarding Greenwood, why do these histories get so buried? Like anger, you know? And then realizing that the antidote to some of that anger was healing and wondering, you know, how do we issue healing? And I think really it became such a simple mantra, like, what do we have as sisters? And the answer is art. The answer is creativity. So we stuck with it. It was a phrase we used well before Send Flowers to Greenwood. We would say it to ourselves, you know, like art is medicine. And we would use that as like a kind of our company culture in the studio. But it became a mantra, I think, for so many others, while they were participating in Send Flowers to Greenwood, and we'll use it again in our future Send Flowers to projects.
I have a question about flowers, really specifically. So I homestead with my partner and I started some flowers this past fall. They haven't grown fully yet. But I do know the goodness of working with living things, working with plants, working with the textures, the beauty, the colors. And so I'm curious, like, what does working with flowers do to your soul? I don't know if that's too abstract, but they're just so beautiful. And, so yeah, what does that do for you? Working with flowers, working with plants, with living things.
It's like Christmas Day every time that we are unboxing flowers from a farmer, a local farmer, or from a wholesaler. We have been in the floral industry for like 8, almost 9 years, and it never gets old. The beauty that each stem can contain. They're also unique and they all have their own personality and temperament and needs. They're like little, like characters in our studio that we tend to individually. But you know, I think for me, I have noticed that on some of my hardest days, whether that's in my personal life or in work, it feels like our flower deliveries for our, you know, to begin work on an event or whatever we've got going on in the studio come at the perfect time. It's like creator knows to send those flowers on that day, because what it does for me is it slows me down, and it slows down a lot of my emotional processing. And there's something so tender and gentle about them. So for someone like me, I was describing having a very feisty personality, for someone like me to work so delicately, to work with things that are sometimes smaller than like the tips of my fingers, you know, it just slows me down, and it creates just so much. I mean, it's very therapeutic. But then I also recognize that those flowers, just like all parts of nature, are very much like part of my relationships. You know, I have relationship to the land. And so I can recognize like that I belong with creation in that sense. It's just really special. I don't know. That's such a trite word, I think, for what we're talking about. But yeah, I would say it's some of the most special work ever.
Yeah, I really resonate with that. I went through part of how I even got into farming and gardening was I went through a season of depression. I never got it like clinically diagnosed, but it was a really tough season. And for some reason, the only thing that made sense to me was to learn how to grow things. Mm. And so I got a job as a part-time like elementary school garden keeper. I didn't even know anything. Like I couldn't have told you a basil plant from a tomato at the time, but I had a mentor who was teaching me. And ever since then, I've just paid a lot of attention to how working with plants and working with living things and having my feet on the earth and hands in the soil. And it's so healing. And I don't really know why or how, and I don't need to know all of those details. Mm-hmm. I just receive it as a gift. And as a mutual belonging, you know, like you said, like I belong to the land, the land is with me and I'm a part of nature and nature's a part of me. And, So when I think about in my daydreams about life, it's like, ooh, maybe I could be a florist one day.
Oh, you totally should.
Okay. So before the conversation keeps going, I wanted to pause to let you know that Leah is about to introduce to us a project that the Wild Mother team took on last year. So what she's about to explain is referring to May 2022. And even though the project and this particular expression of their art as activism and medicine has passed, I still wanted you all to hear about it because it's a really important cause. And the more attention that we can give to this particular cause, to these particular stories, the better. And so when you hear her talk about May, know that she's talking about a year ago, but there are still ways for you to get involved, to lend your ear, and to lend your support to the people that Leah is about to tell us all about. Okay, let's get back to the show.
Well, I'd love to ask you a little bit about your emerging Send Flowers To project. You've alluded to it a couple of times here, and I did a little bit of digging online to read more about what's coming this spring. But can you share more about this project and maybe how listeners can get involved if they want to?
Yes. I hope that when you were looking online, we just finished our website, our little landing page for what's coming. So hopefully you saw the most recent updates.
Yes, that's what I saw.
Okay, awesome. So yeah, Send Flowers To has become this annual project for us. It's really probably the highlight of our year to be able to use our art as medicine. So this year we have just been, I think our awareness has just been really heightened about a crisis going on right now all across Turtle Island. And it's a movement. A movement has grown, and it's called MMIW, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. The movement has grown to also recognize that it's missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, trans, and Two-Spirit relatives. And what's really happening is this crisis where female or femme members of our Native communities are literally disappearing from tribal lands. And they are being trafficked. They are being sexually abused. They are being exploited. And in the worst cases, they are being killed. And this whole crisis is unique just because, man, there are some kind of complex policy and legal issues going on here between tribal sovereignty and the sovereignty of nations, and then the way that our federal government has consistently broken treaties and done its darndest to limit that sovereignty. So like a really sad example is that the Indian Civil Rights Act of 1968 states that tribal governments cannot prosecute for an MMIW crime with a fine that's greater than $5,000 or a year in jail. So that's in comparison to a similar crime that did not take place on tribal lands, where we would naturally prosecute for 8 to 13 years in prison. There's a distinct difference between how tribal governments are able to protect their own communities in comparison to what the federal government would allow for states. And another important thing to note about the policy issue is that missing persons cases legally can only be investigated by the FBI. So this leaves the tribes very limited in what they're able to do. So what has happened is criminals know this, and they target Indigenous lands. They target Indigenous women in particular to traffic and be devious and whatever is happening in those times where they go missing or between their disappearance and their murders. And that leaves our communities, literally community members using their spare time to organize search parties, to act as the FBI and create investigations, to heal with their community members who are reeling after their, you know, daughters or friends or lovers or whatever go missing. It's all on the backs of community members who are underfunded for this work. So the MMIW issue, it definitely feels twofold. Number one, it's a policy issue, but just like Greenwood, it's also an awareness issue. This has been going on, like I stated, that Civil Rights Act in 68, but we have records of this stuff happening well before. And the laws limiting tribes have been, it's like an age-old story. So my sisters and I have really become aware of that, not only in our own region, but it's all across Canada, all across the Southwest, all across the Northeast, girls and women going missing every day. And we want to install some flowers this May at the First Americans Museum, which is here in Oklahoma City, where we will pay homage to those who have gone missing. We will create space for the family members who are still grieving. We want to create supportive and healing environments for those who are doing the boots on the ground work to find these women and girls. And then we really want to empower our community to address policymakers. We have, you know, as community members, we have a responsibility to protect ourselves, and we can do that through the law, and we can I think a lot of times it just takes awareness about what laws are actually not beneficial to us and our community. So I really want those who follow the Sunflowers to MMIW project to be thinking about how law and lawmakers impact this issue.
Are there ways that people will be able to support or donate or any of those things?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So just like last year, this is a crowdfunded endeavor. And we work with a large team of volunteers, even, you know, from the very beginning of launching the project all the way to the installation of the flowers. So we are beginning our fundraising efforts right now. There's a GoFundMe that's available for donating at any level. Every dollar counts, literally, especially when it comes down to the week where we'll be working on the installation. We will use funds to feed our volunteers. It's, you know, down to the very practical nature of it. And then we also are accepting sponsorships from corporations and organizations. We'll be doing some, you know, applications for grants and things like that for our art to be installed. We're looking to raise about $61,000, which is the cost of Sunflowers to Greenwood last year. And we're thinking we'll need about the same amount this year. And then, you know, I think a huge part of a big way to support the movement would just be to sharing about it. As the Wild Mother shares from our platforms, and as you start to see other artists talk about it using that hashtag Sunflowers to MMIW, jump on board with that. Start to educate yourself so that you can educate other people about the crisis. And then I think the third thing that would be really special to me is if you show up in May at the First Americans Museum, our installation will be available to view May 7th through 9th. And this is just on the heels of MMIW Awareness Day, which is May 5th. So come and spend time in Oklahoma City and see how we do our site-specific work.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing this new initiative and to raising awareness and to sending some resources that way, because it really is just so important. I don't know that I can even really capture the significance of this work. And so thank you for making this opportunity for people who aren't in Oklahoma to get involved and to amplify this really important topic and issue and story. So important.
Yes. Well, thanks for doing your part. Even just having me here to talk about it is so important, and I appreciate that.
Well, to land the plane here, I have my final question, which might be a big one, but when you look at the world around you, what are you longing for?
That is a big question. What I think.
Take your time.
Yeah. You might just be catching me on this day, but something that has been significant for me today is the idea of integrity, the idea of working with integrity, which sometimes means that, at least in our business, we cannot be involved with certain potential clients or gigs or whatever that may look like. And that tends to, it can affect, you know, your bottom line. It can make you feel like you're living in scarcity. But I would love to see our world protect those people around us who have integrity and who work with integrity, who allow their actions to align with their words and their declarations. And especially in this conversation about justice issues, I think one of the most disheartening things that people can do to minoritized communities is to speak things that sound really good and then for your actions to not quite align. It's maybe more damaging than the initial harm, that because you've set up an expectation for people that you will be good and that you will be kind and loving in your community. So I really long for integrity, not only in my life, but, you know, even in the places that I don't see and that I don't know about. I know that sometimes integrity or lack of integrity gets in the way of what could be really good and fruitful community interactions. That's my answer today. I don't know, maybe tomorrow would be different.
Oh, well, it's a great answer for today. Really, really rich. I'm just so thankful for your time and your story and your work. And I'm really looking forward to continuing to follow all that you're up to and to amplifying it in any way that I can. So thanks so much, Leah.
I appreciate you so much. Thank you for having me.
I am so thankful to Leah for having this conversation with me. And if you are interested in learning more about the Wild Mother, if you want to learn more about these Send Flowers to projects, you can check that out at the link in my show notes here. And if you are new to A More Beautiful Way, welcome to this project. Welcome to this new body of work. I'm really excited to bring to you more conversations at the intersections of slow living, sacred living, beauty, creativity, and bringing healing hearts, minds, and bodies to the work of social change. Please pause, rate, and review this show. It will help new listeners find this good work that we're doing. And you can support A More Beautiful Way by following along on Substack and on Instagram. All of these links are available to you in the show notes. And until next week, be well. Bye.